Coates is an associate professor with a joint appointment in music and media studies at the University of Western Ontario. She's been writing and researching popular music and identity and popular music and other media for a very long time. That's what she today her talk is called Hootenanny Television and the Authentic Commercial. Please welcome.
The Kingston Trio may be responsible for the bad reputation of popular music on television in the 1960s. Music historian Robert Cantwell marks the beginning of the folk revival of the late 1950s to the early 1960s with the group's release of Tom Dooley in 1958. That record set off a commercial and popular vogue for clean-cut young men strumming guitars and banjos while singing folk songs from many lands. It also brought to the surface long-simmering tensions around commercialism in the folk community. A fundamental issue was that the larger folk community realized that artists needed to make a living. Moreover, many revered folk artists, including Pete Seeger, recorded for major labels. The Weavers, his group at the time, recorded for Columbia, one of the biggest ones. Many within the community wanted folk songs to be heard by a larger public for political, social, and cultural reasons. At the core of debate was the problem of who was more deserving of commercial gain. Those with a true political and social commitment to the music, its values and what it represented, or those who were perceived as trying to exploit a trend. Also an issue was how to tell the difference between those two positions. Thankfully, television, in the form of an ABC, and I'm talking about the United States, so networks, in the form of an ABC program, Hootenanny, would provide a way for the community to resolve that problem, a solution that would travel into rock culture once Bob Dylan and others plugged in their guitars in the mid-1960s. Despite evidence and scholarship that refutes it, the era between Elvis Presley's induction into the Army in 1957 and the Beatles' February 9, 1964 appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show is still sometimes portrayed as a near-death experience for rock and roll. The pause button might have been hit on the rock and roll that erupted out of and disturbed the imagined quiescence of the mid-1950s, but the ample evidence of a vibrant musical landscape, including early Motown and Stax, R&B, the girl group sound, and surf music, get swept under a discursive rug trod upon by insipid teen idols, often emerging out of Philadelphia via television's American Bandstand. Almost always omitted from the premature announcement of rock and roll's near death is the existence of another extremely vibrant and fertile musical genre, one that appealed to older teens and college students at that very moment. The folk revival was at its height from 1958 to the start of the British invasion. The bracketing, if not outright omission of folk, which was all over the Billboard charts of that era, is telling. Youth music of the late 1950s and early 1960s is imagined as that targeted and consumed by teens and younger children. Youth, in this case, is more an ideological construct than an ontological or even chronological state. By aligning youth with teen musical tastes in this period, other musical forms, particularly folk music, are unsullied by their popularity during rock and roll's so-called fallow period. I've been making an argument for years, but I also want to note that Devin Powers makes it in some wonderful work she's been doing recently on music criticism of the 60s. The early 1960s was a fraught period for the American television industry. The fallout from the quiz show and payola scandals in the late 1950s and very early 1960s enabled the three networks to finally wrest control of programming from sponsors and advertising agencies. But what media historian Mark Alvey characterizes as an atmosphere of crisis and criticism hung over the industry. Not only was there the very real threat of increased FCC regulation, that's the regulatory board, like the CRTC, that's its equivalent in the US, but changing demographics, especially the increasing financial and cultural impact of the baby boom and the civil rights movement, posed new programming and institutional challenges. The network's increased use of independent producers led to a reinvigoration of programming and some degree of innovation with program form and audience construction, albeit within the constraints of network policy, practices, and profit expectations. The story of Hootenanny, a folk music variety program initially developed by an independent producer for the ABC network and broadcast from 1962 to 1964, illustrates the constraints and complications of network television of the era. These constraints, combined with the omission of the popularity of folk music amongst pre-rock audiences during the period of rock and roll's cultural interregnum, enabled folk ideologues and revivalists, both artists and gatekeepers of various types, to resolve the long-standing conundrum of commercialism in the revival by deflecting the problem, or more accurately, the blame, onto television. In this presentation, argue that the controversy that ensued when ABC blacklisted Pete Seeger, the moral conscience of the folk revival, and thereby prevented him from appearing on Duke and Nanny, ABC's move helped to obscure the commercial aspects of so-called purist folk revivalists and demagogues by enabling them to demonize television and its industry, characterizing all involved with Hootenanny, including some of the musicians who appeared on it, as villains, seeking to rob folk music of its political and social context, and more importantly, its authenticity, in order to turn it into a safe form of non-confrontational mainstream entertainment. Note to self, edit that sentence. I present research into the conception and original development of the program to complicate the perception of Hootenanny as a purely exploitative gamble damaged by a television network. This is not to suggest that ABC was correct in blacklisting Seeger, but to suggest that the program, especially as originally conceived by its independent producer, was a calculated risk for zero. Moreover, the backlash against Hootenanny and ABC, especially the boycott by major folk artists, was not as unified as commonly narrated. The controversy further obscured the debate over commercialism that haunted the folk revival and its discursive representatives, and enabled rock culture, as it's developed, to obfuscate its own deep debt to and implication with the major commercial record industry. Because as you well know, there was this indie label thing didn't exist back then. You wanted to go on record and record it for one of the big ones. In light of all the potential pitfalls and controversies, it is remarkable that ABC broadcast a folk music program at all. Hootenanny fit with ABC's youth-oriented programming, and furthered its differentiation from the two more established networks, CBS and NBC, but controversy was latent in folk music and its culture. The folk revival's conceptual and real connection to the civil rights movement had potential to cause problems for networks and sponsors wary of offending Southern affiliates. Related to this were the numbers of African-American, and in the case of Miriam Makeba, African folk performers, some in mixed groups with white performers, all of whom could spark objections amongst certain viewers and sponsors. Folk music's lyrical content, especially that of the protest music or topical music that was gaining popularity in the early 1960s, alongside the more commercial variant, could cause problems for networks. The efficacy of programming for a teen to young, that is, unmarried adult audience, married people were pretty young back then, you know, teenagers, 19, 20 years old was the average age. Anyway, that efficacy was yet to be determined. Yet the willingness to broadcast music and performers who threatened to alienate Southern affiliates could at the same time be interpreted as an earnest attempt by the network to fulfill its public service obligations in the service of cultural uplift. Scheduling a folk music program in 1962 during prime time was a tacit recognition of the diverging taste of the baby boom generation. That these tastes had to be served for commercial purposes, that is, in service of creating or enlarging the market for goods advertised with Hootenanny, should not undermine or obscure the many risks that ABC took in order to reap that commercial gain. What ABC executives believed they could not ignore was the continued anti-communist sentiment that still pervaded American social, economic, and cultural discourses. This is, of course, at the height of the Cold War, and not long after the whole Bay of Pigs event in the United States in 1962. The original idea for Hootenanny was floated by Fred Weintraub, owner of the Bitter End, a coffee house still located at 147 Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village, and an important player in the Greenwich Village folk scene, especially for his support of emerging folk and comic artists, like Woody Allen got a start at the Bitter End. Weintraub was friendly with Ted Ashley, then the head of New York's Ashley Steiner Talent Agency, and later in the decade, the head of Warner Brothers Films. Talent agents were instrumental in brokering relationships between independent producers and television networks at that moment. Weintraub pitched the idea of a folk music program to Ashley, one that would feature people singing folk songs to an audience at, of course, the Bitter End. He already had a radio show that did that. Ashley floated the idea to Gil Cates, the young producer he represented. Cates, then in his mid-20s and a fan of folk music, was interested in the idea and in producing the pilot, but thought that the Bitter End would be too limiting from a production standpoint. Cates recently passed away, but he, for years, was the producer of the Oscar television show for many, many years, and when he passed away, was a faculty member at UCLA and was running their play, the Geffen Playhouse there. Case suggested that a folk singing program be shot at, he thought the Bitter End would be too limiting. He suggested that a folk singing program be shot at various college campuses, better for filming new talent and for shooting visuals. Hootenanny, as he conceived it, would be innovative in that it would require the use of remote production units, an uncommon practice for television series of the era, and for unique approaches to filming the acts and the audience. Moreover, college campuses had served as hospitable venues for folk performances since the 1940s and provided a well-established circuit for touring folk acts. Kate's challenge was how to visualize folk music and make it interesting for a television audience, especially the young audience that was difficult for television to capture. Folk aesthetics were not flashy, and performers lacked the visual interest of rock and rollers. Folk lyrics were of paramount importance. Folk was music to be listened to, not watched. Production files indicate that Kate's solution was to focus his pitch to network executives on live campus audiences as they watched the performers. Focusing on the audience made sense for several reasons. Any television program is constructed and then appealed to a particular audience in order to attain some degree of success, or at least enough to satisfy sponsors so that they will support it with advertising. By focusing on the audience and not the performers or even the genre in any great detail, Kate was able to downplay the oppositional politics attributed to some folk music and performers, as well as the aspects of folk music and the folk revival that were explicitly linked to the civil rights movement. It was crucial to retain implicit links. Scripts for the pilot were loaded with coded language that referred to the civil rights struggle, but in a manner that universalized it along a more generally humanitarian line. Concerts would be taped live so that Hootenanny would have a natural, unrehearsed, and unmediated feel. The at-home audience would therefore feel invited into the program as if they, too, were sitting in the hall with a live audience. They could then become complicit in any number of ideologically motivated fiction that in this context served commercial purposes, including folk authenticity and television realism. Kate's called performers for the pilot from several extensive lists of established folk revival stars and emerging acts, at least one supplied by Weintraub. And amongst the developing acts was one, Bonnie Dillon. He conceived of the role of host not as an Ed Sullivan-style MC, but as a heightened type of audience member in order to reproduce the intimacy and community of the coffee house or the folk festival. He hired New York City radio personality Gene Shepherd to host the pilot from another list of possibilities from various pockets of the entertainment world. Kate described Shepherd, as he described this to me in an interview, as subversive. He was intelligent, everything that network television was not. The 90-minute pilot was taped on November 18, 1962 at Sims Hall, a woman's dining hall at Syracuse University, which was Kate's alma mater. Tables and chairs were removed so that the audience could sit on the floor. The show was staged in the round, with the audience sitting around three sides of it, in order to represent, if not reproduce, the informal mood of real Hootenannies. The final list of performers included the Limelighters, Joe Mapes, Glenn Yarborough, Mike Settle, the gospel group, and Clara Ward singers. According to Kate, ABC loved the pilot once it was produced and wanted to put it on their schedule. ABC was happy to retain Kate with the project, but under the condition that he either produce or direct it. They did not want him to do both, as the network wanted ultimate control over the product. Splitting production and direction was a way of maintaining checks and balances, a better way to assure that one viewpoint was balanced by the other. The network's demand was unacceptable to Kate, and he walked away from it. ABC then re-edited the pilot, according to Kate's. Excerpts from it were broadcast at the end of Hootenanny's first season. This was, according to Kate's, the good reason for his departure. When I interviewed him, he also provided what he called the real reason for his departure, which, you know, we can't take the veracity of either, but it's just another idea. He wanted to book Pete Seeger, and ABC's vice president for programming, former songwriter Ted Fetter, said no. The network's position shocked Kate's, quote, as an American. Kate's, despite his self-description as politically middle of the road, suspected that the network thought that Seeger was too liberal, Kate was too liberal for them. He also thought that the network was still timid about the representation of African-American artists on the program. He remembered that the network, upon viewing the pilot, told him that the Clara Ward singers were on too long. Kate's believed that they said this because the group was African-American and somewhat enthusiastic in their performance, but I can't verify that. After Kate's departure, ABC, I keep looking at the same time I have, so I don't need to miss up the clue. After Kate's department, ABC tinkered with the format a bit, but not as much as it could. They replaced Kate's with musical theater composer Richard Lewine, more recently a production executive at CBS. The network hired Jack Linklater, a folk neophyte and son of TV personality Art, to MC. The in-the-round staging, innovative for the early 1960s, was maintained, as well as the traveling format in which each episode would be shot on a different campus. The loose Houdini feel was also preserved. The program traveled to and filmed segments at several American colleges and universities, including Boston University, Penn State, Brown, UCLA, the University of Virginia, the University of Florida, Tulane, Southern Methodist University, and Rutgers. Case's desire to focus on the audience was implemented through much direct address to the audience by Linkletter, in his guise of tour guide and translator, as well as exhortations from performers in the audience and MC to join in the singing. The Hootenannies were filmed live and edited so that you see this rapport. So let's just watch it for a couple of minutes. I'm getting my better wrap up. Support for the boycott was not as unified as it's now represented. The overtly political Chad Mitchell Trio appeared on the program, in fact that was them singing, several times, once singing a protest song about the John Birch Society. Doc Watson appeared after making clear that unlike other artists such as Baez, he could not afford not to appear. Pete Seeger himself is described as ambivalent about the boycott, as he was, in the words of Watson biographer Kenneth Gustafson, more interested in the young people of the country being exposed to traditional folk music than he was in playing out his vendetta against the ABC network. Joan Baez was just waiting to go on one day when they would remove the boycott. She said no, and so her manager was more than happy to have her be on the show. Judy Collins, in her recent autobiography, asserts that Seeger told a gathering of folk singers meeting to discuss the boycott that not doing the show would hurt the entire folk music. The Hootenanny controversy and boycott provided a solution of sorts to this growing schism about commercialism between purists and traditional folk music, and also those who preferred a more political approach to music. These two positions, which had taken on the appearance of war camps within the less overtly commercial side of the folk revival, were enabled by the boycott and Hootenanny to present the semblance of a unified front against exploitative and commercial elements. The catalyst was Seeger's treatment by ABC, but a subtext might have been the perceived wresting of control by the public of the public face of the revival by a television network. It was clear that the folk community wanted to get folk's message out to a wider audience. It was also clear that a certain subset of that community wanted to keep that control with them. Hootenanny represented the end of the folk community's control over music, essentially. For example, Robert Shelton, the New York Times folk music critic and Dylan biographer, lambasted the application of the word Hootenanny to shoe styles, pinball machines, vacations, and even, in his words, dreadful magazines, including the one that he edited. An article in Shelton's Hootenanny mag might have contributed as much to the demonization of television music by folk ideologues and gatekeepers as the Seeger blacklisting and artist boycott. And Judy Collins, Why I Quit the ABC Show, singer calls for artistic boycott of television Hootenanny program, Collins asserts that she quit the program after three appearances for aesthetic and artistic reasons. My quitting has nothing to do with the Pete Seeger issue, Collins proclaimed. Rather, she objected strenuously to how the show was produced, claiming that they've utilized talent miserably and have created a monster that threatens to destroy folk music. Her opinion about the show has mellowed with time, although she supports an earlier article by noting that by the end of the second season, Hootenanny's producers were cutting verses and forcing performers into strict time limits. She acknowledges that because of the program, millions of viewers saw traditional and commercial folk artists some singing protest songs. Hootenanny also hosted interracial groups at a time when such appearances still rankled. Although the big-name artists who refused to appear in Hootenanny are often trotted out when the show is mentioned, many others did not boycott the show, including those who went on to become big names in the rock of the era, like Mama Cass, David Crosby, and Jim, later known as Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. Nevertheless, with her statements in Hootenanny magazine, Collins most likely, unknowably, created the template for the denigration of television as a vehicle for presenting, quote, authentic popular music. Television, and by extrapolation, other ancillary or overtly commercial media, could be critiqued on aesthetic and political grounds, even while artists and record labels profited from it. Most of all, the problem of commercialism that previously but bedeviled folk performers, purists, and gatekeepers was solved. The solution hinged on integrity and authenticity. Even if those precise words were not uttered, they were certainly implied. Intent became paramount in the creation of an authentic commercial mode, one opposed to an inauthentic commercial one. Hootenanny permitted folk arbiters to work this out, conveniently just in advance of the changes in the popular music scene that would soon be wrought by the British invasion. This rapprochement with the commercial and segmenting of the commercial into authentic and inauthentic forms would be transmitted straight into the bloodstream of rock culture as it began to develop in the mid-1960s.
Questions?
This may not be a silly question, but was Hootenanny, were people actually performing live, or
yes.
was it stage like home with the props?
Well, no, you know, it was definitely, I'm sorry I didn't get to show most of it, and then you can buy this on the Shout Factory video. It's not the full shows, but it's excerpts. You can find them on YouTube as well, but decontextualized, the whole thing is decontextualized. I've not yet been able to view a full show. There's only a couple of them extant. They're up there for you. No, they were, it was filmed, so things would be edited together, but they were shot very simple stages, basically people sitting around, strumming their guitars and singing. It was supposed to, usually often they were in the round, so the audience was all around them. But it was supposed to bring you there. There were a lot of audience shots.
So it was live? Like,
yes.
It was supposed to like lip synced?
No, it was performed live.
Okay. So
and these were, basically, they would go to the shows, they would go to these schools, they would hand out tickets to the student body and bring people in. I had to cut a lot of stuff out, but like they were really afraid of having co-ed with short skirts and cameras around. And they would put on a concert for the show, for the school.
One of the things I was intrigued by is kind of how the framing of the audience is part of the show and how they try to create and demonstrate the audience experience in that genre. I'm curious if there's lines that can be drawn then in subsequent programming in other genres, so whether it's Bandstand or whether it's Soul Train, were there like lessons from here that might have translated how those shows then began demonstrating audience behavior?
Probably not. I mean, Bandstand would have, I would say no, because these were so, we're so kind of one-off and done by different producers. You know, Bandstand had a particular style. They always had, you know, they preceded this show by a decade. And before that, there were dance, these kind of teen dance programs, kind of a hallmark of early television as well. Shindig and Hullabaloo that came out right after this one, Shindig was done by a British producer who'd been doing television since the mid-1960s. I have an article about him coming out pretty soon at JPMS. Hullabaloo was done by a guy doing that most recently was Judy Garland show, and his director Steve Binder had done Steve Allen shows like that still back in the 50s. So it was pretty much. You know, Gil Cates would have stuck with it, but they ended up putting an old, so it's more kind of like, let's just do variety. And this was Cates, I got interested in this project, well, partly because I'm writing this book about TV and music, but I found these papers at the University of Wisconsin Archives. I went to grad school there, and just messing around one day looking for things. And, oh my gosh, there's Hootenanny, they're a pilot. So no, I don't think there was a lot of, I think there was more connection from, if anything had a big influence, it was the two things. Connections from the Monkees, believe it or not, and connections from Hullabaloo, because they were already kind of tight in the industry. Ms. Bond, Dr. Bond?
Can you talk a little bit about more about the term hootenanny? Because okay. you're talking about the profusion of the term.
Yeah.
And I'm also wondering, is this something that was actually much in use in
absolutely. No. In fact, this is 12 pages from a 40 page chapter. The term was one of the reasons why the Pete Seeger boycott so galled the folk community, is that the term was probably coined by Pete Seeger in the 40s, when he and was part of the Almanac Singers with Woody Guthrie, and like they would do rent parties and call them hootenannies. So it became kind of a folk music thing. You would sit and you'd have your hootenannies. This whole atavistic, let's go back to back to our folk past. But the hootenanny was something that had started up by Seeger. They even had hootenannies in Carnegie Hall. It became a thing, associated with the movement. And again, the idea that it might have started with its modern usage might have started with Seeger was especially galling. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
So I don't even like folk music that much. So anyway.